Get this. More than half of the farmers surveyed by the California Farm Bureau report that over half of their farmland is not being farmed because of an ongoing shortage of farm labor. So we ask, who is going to work on our farms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,147th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Tokyo who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Now, I had a conversation the other day with an 86-year-old former California farmer. Now, this gentleman was not just a former farmer. He's also a retired PhD college professor and a semi-retired local agriculture banker. When our conversation tuned to the subject of farm labor, as conversations with farmers do these days, I asked him what happened to the Bracero Guest Worker Program. And without a nanosecond of hesitation, he looked me in the eye and he said, "That damn Cesar Chavez." When Cesar started listening to the AFL-CIO, it was all over. When I asked how the Bracero program worked for him, he replied, "We had to have two local workers for every guest worker, which meant if we had 20 guest workers, we had to go to town and hire 40 local workers. So that's what we did to have those guest workers. You have to understand that farm work is skilled labor. Those guest workers were not only skilled, they had a work ethic that you would not believe. We would do anything to keep them, even to the extent of hiring local derelicts." That from a guy who lived it. The guest worker program is no more. The open border has been closed, and we are now left with a monumental change in the nation's agriculture. What does that change look like? Well, this is something that our producer dug up for us. More than 55% of 762 farmers and ranchers surveyed in a California Farm Bureau Federation report from October 2017 said half of their land continues to go unattended because of an ongoing labor shortage directly related to U.S. immigration policy. Not a pretty picture when half of our ability to grow food is out of business because there's no one to do the work. So we ask, who is going to work on our farms? So with us today, we have three people who should really give us a good picture of where to start. We're going to start with Guadalupe Sandoval, who is with the California Farm Labor Contractors Association. Lupe, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program.
Good morning.
Good to have you aboard. So as a contractor, your job is to provide labor to farmers, right?
Well, just to clarify, I am the executive director for this association. I am not a farm labor contractor myself.
Okay.
In my youth, I did work for farm labor contractors as well as for growers, but right now the association that I manage is an association of and for farm labor contractors. And it's increasingly a challenge for farm labor contractors, as it is with growers. I think that's one of the issues that is oftentimes confusing, is I think that we still maybe have this antiquated picture of how agriculture works, which is just farmer on a lovely little farm with either managing it himself and his family with perhaps a couple of hired hands. But California is a very labor-intensive industry. It's not like agriculture in the Midwest where you can have a farmer on a machine threshing all kinds of wheat and corn and other crops that are very low labor intensive. California has extremely labor intensive crops such as strawberries, grapes, cherries, asparagus, on and on. We lead the country in agricultural production, but most of that production is very labor intensive, and that labor doesn't come from the kind of labor that you might see in other industries. It's really hard work. It's not the greatest paying work overall. It's seasonal work overall. And so we've come to depend on a primarily immigrant workforce. And farmers themselves are still primarily, shall we say, Anglo-Saxon, English speakers. It's difficult for them to recruit workers from this primarily Spanish-speaking immigrant workforce, so many of them rely on farm labor contractors, a third-party intermediary who recruits, manages, pays the laborers who provide the work on these labor-intensive farms.
You know, I sometimes...
Those workers are becoming fewer and far between.
Yeah, Lupe, I sometimes think that farmers these days are more like building contractors than they are farmers. You know, whereas farmers used to be out in the field plowing their land or whatnot, today farmers are kind of like the people who hire everything else to be done. And you know, they're kind of the business person that rides around in a white truck with a cell phone and makes sure things happen that way. Might be wrong. I'm going to introduce our other guest today, Lowell Hurst, who is a retired high school ag teacher, long time, also mayor of Watsonville, California, which is right in the heart of the Pajaro Valley agriculture. Lowell, welcome to Food Chain Radio Program.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here from the sunny Pajaro Valley and enjoying all the bounty that surrounds Watsonville and the vicinities.
Yeah, you know, for the people far, far away, perhaps listening in that other kind of agriculture country, in the heartland of the country, you know, where you have a farmer sitting on a big tractor, a lot different in the Pajaro Valley, isn't it? It's kind of like what Lupe said, it's labor-intensive stuff.
Well, it is, and the specialty crops that are grown here and the fragility of the fruit and the necessary cooling that needs to take place and moving those products to market and as fast as possible. You know, that's a big distinction here. And plus our focus on organic and niche marketing as well.
So it's pretty intelligent labor then, isn't it?
Well, it is skilled labor, and it has to be performed correctly and efficiently and fast as well, and much rides upon it because any kind of contamination or mishandling of these high-value crops, that can lead to a collapse of the market.
Big trouble. You've been teaching for a long, long time. Did you find it difficult to try to talk students into going into agriculture?
Well, I think the parents always want their students to be doctors and lawyers and accountants and to wear white shirts and ties, at least in the past. But there are many occupations in agriculture where you can do all of those things, and agriculture needs accountants that are familiar with ag operations.
Probably brain surgeons too, right?
I would hope so. You know, I think there's a lot of thought that needs to go into agriculture, and it's not just the stoop labor that many people see as they drive by the fields.
Well, good.
But labor is important all the way around, and different levels of knowledge and labor.
Well, good. Also with us today, we have Sophia Wilmore, who is the intern producer of Food Chain Radio Program, with us from the University of California. Sophia, you come from a white-collar background. You actually went to Cesar Chavez Elementary Charter School, right?
I did, yes.
And you were raised in a middle-class family, and yet here you are looking to... You weren't.
No, I was actually raised in a lower-class family.
Lower-class, okay.
But in a very privileged, very white, so to speak, very rich town of Santa Barbara.
Okay. I just think of Santa Barbara. I think there's nothing low-class there. But at any rate, here you are in the University of California.
Mm-hmm.
You're majoring in environmental studies with a focus on agriculture.
Yeah.
And you're looking for a way of getting into agriculture and finding it difficult to find a way into agriculture.
Yeah, specifically, my focus is actually in agroecology and sustainable food systems, which goes along with environmental studies. So specifically with that kind of agriculture that's not mainstream, I think that a lot of people who are studying what I study don't see a lot of opportunities in that field.
Looking for a way in, can't find a way in. And yet, here's agriculture starving for people to come in and pick up the reins and join us. So the subject today, folks, is who is going to be growing our food? This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We have with us Guadalupe Sandoval. We call him Lupe because that's what he likes to be called, I think. He's with the California Farm Labor Contractors Association, executive director. His folks help farmers find labor. Where we have Lowell Hurst, retired high school ag instructor, Mr. Mayor, I call him, of Watsonville, California, and Sophia Wilmore of the University of California Environmental Ag Program. And we have you. You're always welcome to participate at the, on the Food Chain Radio program at metrofarm.com. Right back. Stay tuned.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, big question for one and all. Who is going to grow our food? Who's going to work on the land? Who is going to go out there and pick the crops? Who's going to go out there and water them? Who's going to do the work? California Farm Bureau asked over 700 farmers in California about their labor situation. Over half of those farmers said over half of their farmland is in fallow because they can't find workers. That's a pretty dire situation. If you think about half of our productive farmland not being farmed. Let's go to Lupe Sandoval. Do your farm labor contractors, are they seeing this too, or is this a hallucination by the Farm Bureau, Lupe?
Well, there are fairly significant surveys of farm workers conducted through U.S. Department of Labor. It's their seasonal agricultural worker survey, and the data is pretty clear that we have a severely restrictive number of workers that are coming into the United States anymore to do agricultural work. It used to be a fairly significant number of workers, of individuals that could come across the border and find work in the United States, but the border has become increasingly tight. It's become increasingly dangerous. It's become increasingly expensive for anybody that wants to immigrate to do these jobs, and so they're not coming. And so as a result, we've got significant labor shortages in different parts of California.
And when I asked, you know, we've been going through this for quite a while. As long as the border was open, it was fine because people could just walk back and forth across the border, work here, whether legal or not, and go back and forth, go home for Christmas and whatnot. Not seem to be working like that anymore. As a matter of fact, I sat in on a conversation recently where a longtime laborer here in California, 17 years working here illegally, his brother in Mexico had cancer and he wanted to go home, but he can't figure out how to get back legally to take his job.
He can get that. That's going to be extremely difficult for him. He can make it back to Mexico to see his brother. He will spend a ton of money to come back here to the United States if he's not properly documented. It's anywhere from $7,500 to $15,000 for an individual who wants to make that trek with what they call a coyote, somebody who will help cross him from Mexico to the United States. It's extremely dangerous. It's extremely expensive, and it's just not happening very much anymore. The person you're talking to is pretty typical. Workers are just not going back to Mexico anymore. And if they do, they're not coming back this way.
Well, you know, there was a time when people came back and forth legally, and there was an actual program called the Bracero Program. Lowell Hurst, what the heck happened to the Bracero Program, in your estimation?
Well, Michael, I wasn't here during the Bracero Program, so I had to look it up
And I think there's a number of different opinions as to why it worked and why it didn't work and why it was discontinued. Sure. And so there's a lot of academic studies about that, but I think, you know, times do change, and there was a shift of labor. The Bracero program was primarily to replace soldiers that had gone off to war, and then it continued, and it continued all the way to 1964, as I read and remember. So a combination of different political factors and working conditions, and the fact that many braceros didn't get paid, and you know, they weren't happy with the food that was provided, and that was part of the program, and certainly some of the housing situations weren't the of a very high standard either. And so it was phased out. And then what do we do?
Well, what we do is have undocumented workers then, and then we essentially open the border. Lupe Sandoval, wouldn't it make sense for somebody in your position on, and the, you know, the contractors who are part of your association, would it be better for them to have a bracero program, a legal program where you know, people
we do have a bracero program. It's called the H-2A visa program. The H-2A visa program has been around for decades. The bracero program ended in the early 60s, and then later on we picked up with the H-2A visa program, which you might be familiar with other visa programs like the H-1B visa, which allows tech employers to bring in tech employees from other countries, primarily, I think, from like India and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
But the H-2A visa program is to bring seasonal workers into agriculture on a legal visa. Unfortunately, it's an expensive program. You have to provide housing for all the workers that you bring over here. You have to provide for all their transportation from their home area, which is usually for agriculture. It's usually some part of Mexico, southern part of Mexico. From their home residence all the way to wherever they're going to be working here in the United States. You have to provide for their transportation daily from wherever you house them to wherever the work site is. It's expensive. It's complicated. Some people have a hard time understanding this program. The city of Santa Maria recently voted to on a moratorium on housing for H-2A workers within the city limits, which they recently rescinded for about 2 or 3 weeks. They had a moratorium on allowing the use of residential housing for H-2A workers. It's somewhat of a controversial program, I guess you could say, and it is growing in popularity here in California. We now have over 17,000 workers, I believe, for the year 2017. And an increase in interest in 2018. We're seeing a lot of employers who, even with the extreme cost, are looking into and dabbling in this program of H-2A visa workers.
Well, that would seem to make sense in a place like the Pajaro Valley where Lowell Hurst is, because workers there come and work for 9 months a year. And so maybe it would make sense, you know, to fly somebody in from southern Mexico to work. But what if you just need somebody to, you know, pick your pears? And maybe that whole process lasts a week or two. You can't afford to build housing for that or for them or, you know, fly them in from southern Mexico to do that. So wouldn't it be...
Especially in California.
And even on the flip side of that, you know, the program, it's only in 1 year increments. So what if you need someone more long term? Do you have to just keep paying this yearly fee? And how expensive does that get?
It is an expensive program. It's not for everybody, and you do see a lot of return workers year after year. They come back on the same program to the same employer, but they have to go home each year. They can't stay here year-round.
Does everyone have access?
Everybody that wants to apply for it can get it. There's an unlimited number of workers on that currently. But it's extremely expensive. Most people don't want it because it's too expensive. I mean, I don't think I have to talk about affordable housing in California.
Definitely not.
It's not a great housing. You just can't find enough housing, and one, you don't have enough housing for these workers, and two, nobody wants to allow it to be built because of the severe case of NIMBYism that we have. Mm-hmm. There was a case in Nipomo, California, not too far from Santa Maria, where a strawberry grower was building housing for H-2A workers, and just as this project was finishing, somehow that housing mysteriously went up in flames.
Whoa.
Local worker advocates were quick to respond that, you know, everybody loves eating the strawberries, but they don't want the workers in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Okay, folks, we're going to have to take a quick break. What a tough question. You need to have the crops harvested. Farmers like those in the Pajo and Salinas Valley, intensive agriculture that goes on for 9 months a year, they need one kind of workers. Those farmers elsewhere maybe need somebody for a week or two to pick the crop. Different story. So what is the answer? Is there an answer? This is the Food Chain Radio program. We will be right back. Do not go anywhere else.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, here's some interesting numbers that our producer Sophia Wilmore dug up that kind of give pause. If you look at our agriculture, you'll see we're in deep doo-doo. California, for one example, provides more than half of the nation's fruits, nuts, and vegetables. 45% of California farm workers are undocumented, and now we've closed the border, which means half of our farm labor force is at risk. How do your farm labor contractors manage in this environment, Lupe?
Well, it's interesting that a lot of people have really in the agricultural industry, whether it's the employers or the workers, a little bit upset about the new administration and their talk of ridding our country of illegal immigrants, which is our workforce. You know, without that undocumented workforce, well, they're documented to a certain extent. Every employer out there would say, all my workers are documented. They all have to fill out an I-9 form, which shows that they have the legal right to work in the United States. Now, the provenance of those documents that they provide could be questioned, but to the employer, they have documentation and the right to be here to work. Unfortunately, as we're seeing, we just don't have that number of workers. And with the fear of immigration and customs enforcement, the ICE people, we've seen a lot of high-profile activity under the Trump administration. We've seen reports of, 70-some employers were visited by ICE last week, and this was a couple of months ago. I find it somewhat disturbing that we have all these media accounts, but they all come from a president who likes to tweet and likes to announce and likes to engage in very fiery rhetoric to, I guess, engage his base that he's taking care of Americans first. A lot of people don't look at the history that under Obama we had probably at least as many deportations in his administration, if not more. I think a lot of people refer to him as the deporter-in-chief. But he wasn't tweeting about it. He wasn't engaging in all this fiery rhetoric. So it kind of went under the radar.
But
I take it you're a Democrat. It's okay.
It doesn't matter what my political party is. It matters not what a person's political party is when we look at the impact of workers that, in a sense, are afraid to leave their houses sometimes.
Yeah.
Are afraid to go to health care and take care of their kids because they don't want to get on a list somewhere.
So
this is crazy.
It is crazy, and I don't think anybody who would suggest that it's not crazy. Sophia?
You know, I heard you were talking about Obama being the deporter in chief, and, you know, I've heard that as well, but isn't it true that Trump is actually deporting more people who are established in this country? Obama was more focused on people coming in through the border.
Have no idea.
We are finding that there were more deportations at the border. There's just not as much entry into the border anymore, so the deportations aren't going to happen there.
So the problem is, for whatever purpose, we have decided to slow the rate of import of people going back and forth across the border. And we have decided, for one reason or another, that we're going to make it very difficult for agriculture to get workers. So where do we go from here?
Well, Michael, I don't think that the food production should be a political football. I think we need to focus on good quality, high quality food, and of course that takes good high quality workers as well.
Yeah.
I've got an idea.
I like it.
You know, I haven't even heard it yet,
Lowell, but I like it.
Well, thank you very much. A lot of my ideas are not always popular, but I think this one might actually solve some of the problems. You know, as a teacher, I saw a lot of young teenagers from 14 to 18, and they were full of energy, and they really wanted to work. They really wanted to do something with their hands. In fact, they all found something to do with their hands, and sometimes those things weren't as productive as perhaps growing and tending crops. I also found a lot of teenagers that really liked to work outside. They enjoyed an outdoor activity. And so with our child labor laws, we're prohibited from employing youth, and that holds youth back in many ways, and there's a lot of work that youth could do that, if they were properly supervised and safety trained, that they could be productive. And I think, you know, the students that I worked with and ran into, they really wanted to have opportunities to earn money, to work hard, to do outdoor work, and we should be growing our own labor force in agriculture rather than just relying upon imports.
You know, that's an incredible insight, because I guess I was one of those kids working in the field when I was very young. But I just, in today's Wall Street Journal, read an article about how the government has a $2 billion a year program to take children who are essentially foster children who had no parents to raise them, and who are, you know, essentially in trouble, have no place to go. They're spending $2 billion to train them to have work, but they're not doing anything. They're not able to find these kids work other than at McDonald's or something like that. So, you know, is it possible to take kids out of the city and give them the skills to be actual farm workers, and will they want to do it? I'm reminded of a class I took back a number of years, a class on how to do Dreamweaver software programs for managing websites. And I was sitting in this class with 30 other kids, and I was really struggling to keep up because this stuff is complicated. You know, you have to push the right button or you're in China. And one day I just woke up to the fact that every kid in this class with me was playing video games. Every kid in the class. And I freaked out and I looked around. And I after the class, I went up to the professor and I said, "Why are these kids playing video games and I'm the only one listening to you and you're the only one talking to me, but you're pretending to talk to everybody? What's going on?" And he said, "Well, it's a government program. They're all getting paid to do something they really already know how to do. And so that's it. They're just not going to do it." And I wonder about that government program that's spending $2 billion a year to train kids, and it's not going anywhere. So how do you take those kids, Lowell, and give them the skill to go out and work?
Well, I don't think that agricultural occupation should be solely the route of troubled youth, but I think a good hard day's work in the outdoors does change your mind about a number of things, and that you get to understand science and nature and interaction with others, and, you know, but if you're surrounded by a a bunch of criminals or goofballs or some way, something of that nature.
It ain't going to happen.
That's not going to happen either. But I think that for the vast bulk of teenagers and young adults who struggle to find meaning in their life,
might be a way of working.
They want to find something that's relevant, and organic agriculture and agroecology and good farm outdoor labor. Those are good things.
Let's pick that up. When we get back, do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at MetroFarm.com.
2x2.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam. Paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, do you think it's possible to take children out of the city and train them to have good, clean farm work? Is it possible? Boy, I don't know. Lupe Sandoval, as you know, as a executive director of an association of farm labor contractors, what do you see as a possibility? I mean, if you had the ideal magic wand and could fix this, how would you do it?
I think we'd probably be something like the European Union, where we'd have open borders. Where workers that would migrate to jobs as they're available would go to those jobs. When the jobs were over, they would return home. They would go back to their home country, their home state. Unfortunately, as you're aware, under this current administration, under this current political system, we're not going to see anything like that anytime in the near future. We do need an aggressive, some kind of an immigration reform, to allow workers that are already here with some kind of undocumented status, they could live here and gain some kind of documented status, just like we did back in 1986 when we had our last immigration reform. We're way overdue for something like that. We need something that would open up our borders and allow people to come in so that they could work, whether on a temporary visa, perhaps something instead of where employers have to provide housing and transportation, where workers could come in and be free agents. They could say, I'll come to work for Farmer A, but if I get tired of working at Farmer A, I get to go move to Farmer B, because under H-2A, they are restricted to just working for that one employer, and then they have to go home.
May I interject here? It seems like one of the things that I've seen in with respect to farm labor is that they come and become farm laborers, but then they go to work in contracting and build houses. And they, just like everybody else, they're always looking for a better job. And so those who come to do one thing end up doing another thing. And so those who were here are going, gee, what happened to my job?
Well, Michael, that's exactly why growing our own labor force is so important. Many of those people already live here. They already have homes in most cases. And many of those farmers that you mentioned that go on to construction, they do so for extra wages, but many of them return to agriculture as farmers themselves. And so there needs to be an upgrading in the quality of work and the payment of work and the social status of work that young people could find a way to fit in and explore it and see if they like it. And if they don't, they could go on to something else. But right now they're excluded from any kind of agricultural work until they have graduated from high school. And there's
is that really true? You mean high school kids can't go out and work in the fields?
It's my understanding that the liability that the employers have prohibit that. I think that should change, and that young folks get at least a taste of it, and that clearly wages are a big piece of that. But if you're looking for a high school, maybe you're a senior in high school, and maybe you're not going to Berkeley to get a doctorate in medieval philosophy. Maybe you really want to have more of a hands-on experience of some kind, but you don't want to join the Marine Corps.
So there it is. So my notion is that things should always cost what they cost, and that whenever we start subsidizing the cost of something, we change its value and screw everything up. And I think that with respect to farm labor, you know, a lot of the cost of foreign farm labor or undocumented farm labor is borne by the taxpayer. And what if that farm, you know, farmers had to pay the true cost of farm labor and, like Lowell said, pay the real salary, the real wages? Do you see that as in the realm of possibilities, Lupe?
Well, I think that's part of, I would argue that we are paying closer to what the true values are, which is why we're seeing a lot of our production in agriculture go down to Mexico. If you go to your grocery store right now and go to the fruit and produce department, I can offer you an estimate that well over 50% of the produce there was not produced here in California or here in the United States. It's much cheaper for a grower, and we have large growers, guys that are there in the Pajaro Valley, like Driscoll's. They have large farms down in Mexico. They find that it's much cheaper to provide the labor, the land, the regulatory compliance down there than it is here in the United States. And so they do. It's expensive to pay workers an increasingly high minimum wage. Right now it's $11 an hour. It'll soon be $15 an hour for agricultural workers. Their overtime will go down from 10 hours a day of regular time down to 8 hours a day, like a lot of other industries. We're seeing a proposal to increase paid sick leave from 3 days to 5 days. We're seeing a lot of things that are adding to the cost of production here in the United States, especially here in California, which is why a lot of these jobs aren't going to be here in California pretty soon. They're already leaving. You can pretty much rely on that trend is going to continue, that we will have more and more of our production in another country than here in California.
Wow, that doesn't look really cool at all, but going to have to take the last break. But when we come back, I'm going to ask each one of you what you see in the future. What are we going to do? Over half of our farmland here in California now unattended because we can't find anybody to do the labor. And as Lupe says, more and more and more of that labor is moving someplace else, just like China. Who knows? Maybe we'll be getting our strawberries from China if this trend continues. But we'll ask that question. What do you see in our future when we get back from this, the final break? Do stay tuned.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farm to Consumer. FarmLabor.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it doesn't look good, folks. Look out into the farm country of California and across the land. I guess those folks in the heartland of the country where one farmer is now growing 1,000 acres of soybeans by virtue of the blessings of genetically modified crops, no bugs, no weeds. All you could do is sit on the top of a great big giant tractor, listen to Led Zeppelin on the stereo, and mow down the crops, and there you go. But no, it doesn't work like that in other parts of the country where labor is required, and that's here in California, along both coasts, in meat processing facilities, all kinds of different places. We need labor. Where are we going to get that labor? We've closed down the borders. We no longer allow children to work. It's going to get pretty expensive. Let's start with our producer, our intern producer from the University of California, Sophia Wilmer. What do you see at your future, girl?
Yeah, it's kind of a hard question. I think that with, you know, more of my generation coming into the workforce for agriculture, you know, there's not too many of us that actually want to go into farming because we don't see a very bright future for farming. But for those of us that do go into farming, I think that we're going to have to change the way that we do this pretty radically because it's just not working the way that it is now. It worked for a while, and I think that it's just not going to continue to work for the future because it never has been a sustainable option. So I think for my generation, we're either going to have a lot less agriculture in California or we're going to have to go through some major systemic changes.
Lupe Sandoval.
We're going to see more of the same. We're going to see an increase in H-2A workers to a certain extent as we can find housing availability for them. We're going to see increasing mechanization of a lot of crops. We now have machines that will harvest wine grapes, that will harvest almonds, that will harvest tomatoes. Well, they're working on machines to harvest strawberries. Mm-hmm. A lot of the jobs that have gone away in other industries because of mechanization, they're going to continue to be going away in agriculture due to mechanization. You're going to see more and more of our cropland being fallowed here, I believe, and going to work in other countries where it's cheaper to produce. You're going to see more and more labor-intensive crops, such as certain types of berries that are going to be transferred, as we're seeing in the Central Valley, from berries and fruits to nuts.
Wow.
Less labor-intensive, lots of almonds being produced in the Central Valley, and new orchards coming into production every year. You don't need very many workers to grow, shake, and sweep up almonds, which is all done with machines.
Well, I'll be eating almonds forever.
That stuff.
Lowell Hurst, what do you see?
Well, the future is hard to see, but we can look back on the past and interpret it in different ways. There's going to be an increase in technological innovation, mm-hmm. science and technology converging. Certainly, that's going to be a big piece of this. But I don't see fields being converted into condos and housing starts. I don't believe that the fertile Pajaro Valley and Salinas Valley are going to go that way. But there is a need for more housing. And
there's the rub.
And I think that we should take that money that is utilized for farm worker housing for guest workers, and that we should utilize that as an investment.
Okay, we're just ran out of time, Lowell. I want to thank you, Lupe, and Sophia. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, Mike Lowell's the third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.